Welcome to The Corner Table, a podcast about food and drink in Madison, Wisconsin, produced by the Capital Times. I am your host, Lindsay Christians, food editor at the Cap Times. We are going week by week with Bravo's Top Chef Wisconsin. First up, Milwaukee food writer and frequent Cap Times freelancer, Nicole Hazy, joins me to talk about what was up with the Chaos Challenge. We are still not sure. Nicole has a culinary degree in baking and pastry, and she has some great insights into the dairy dessert quickfire as well. Then I'm chatting with Paul Bartolotta, a Milwaukee restaurateur with a resume as long as my arm. Chef Paul has won 2 James Beard Awards. He's got 17 restaurants and catering facilities in the greater Milwaukee area, including Bacchus, Lake Park Bistro, and Harbor House. And he was a massive champion of bringing Top Chef here to Wisconsin. There are spoilers ahead for episode 6, that's the Chaos Cuisine episode of Top Chef. Watch live on Bravo every Wednesday night, or you can catch up on Peacock the day after episodes air, typically by midday on Thursday. Give a listen. Cheers! Hello, Nicole, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So for folks who maybe don't know you yet, can you give us a little bit about you and your Milwaukee food background?
Yeah, so I am a freelance journalist. I also went to baking and pastry school and worked in that area for a good portion of my life. I have a journalism degree, didn't do it for a little while, moved on to pastry, came back to journalism is the short story of that. So yeah, I was born and raised in Milwaukee, went to college in New Orleans, thought I'd never come back. When I left Milwaukee in the year 1999, it was a very different food scene than it is now. Very excited to be here, but in retrospect, very funny to kind of look at how things have changed. But yeah, I write for the Cap Times, write for the Journal Sentinel. So yeah.
When Milwaukee started getting on this national stage for Top Chef stuff, I was really surprised. But I wonder, do you agree with the idea that like now is the time for Wisconsin to have a season like this?
Yes. I mean, I think I could, you could probably argue that it's past time, but that's okay too. Seriously, the change in the food scene in about 20 years is just kind of mind-blowing. There's still plenty, I think, gaps in some of the cuisine that we could have. I personally, like, the dessert scene here is not great in terms of, like, if it's 8 o'clock and I want something after my meal, like, where can I go? That doesn't really exist here. We love a donut. Don't go much further beyond pastry. But, yeah, there's so many interesting chefs doing so many great stuff and so much great stuff. And they kind of say it on Top Chef, but it's a thing I've said all along, which is that, like, this is where your food comes from. So, you know, we grow so much different stuff here. We, you know, we raise livestock, the dairy, like there's so many great fresh ingredients here. So farm to table, I feel like we call restaurants that here, but for some places that's just always what they've been and they didn't need like that title. They just were using the stuff around them. So yeah, it feels like it's great to see Milwaukee and Wisconsin get that focus and not have it just be like beer, cheese, and brats. Like, obviously they're showcasing those things, but I feel like thus far they've done it in a really fun and interesting way, though I thought it was really interesting to, like, this whole challenge, like the judges, none of them were local people. And so, like, we did a dairy dessert with nobody from the dairy state, which I thought was really weird.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's really cool. It's really cool to see. Like, I've just loved watching the highlight and see and watch, you know, watching the media ahead of time when they talked about how much great stuff is here. It's just been really, really nice and like sort of like really heartwarming.
So let's dig into the quickfire, that dairy dessert challenge. Looking at the table of examples of dairy desserts, what stood out to you?
Well, it was interesting. I felt like I was like, I know what each of these, right? There was custard, there was Racine Kringle, they looked like Italian cookies, probably from like Sciortino's. So I thought that was really fun and cool to be able to like pick out where each of those things were. And also that other than the cream puffs, nothing that was on there is something that anybody made.
So I thought that was really funny, actually. I was like, they gave you all of these beautiful desserts, which surely they and the crew got to eat after they were filming, but none of them made any of those things except for the cream puff, which was, he did like a black cream puff with tahini, I think.
Black sesame in the bottom of a black bowl. I was like, why is this the plating that's happening right now? Like, you have done yourself no favors.
Yeah.
I think I'd been kind of waiting for a challenge sort of like this. Although there are other ones that I'm also waiting for, like an old-fashioned kind of challenge or, I don't know, some others. But anyway, the dairy challenge seemed to me almost more down the middle in terms of like straightforwardness than the cheese challenge did, where everybody was like, croquettes!
I feel like you could come back to that every time you talk about this.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy to me. As a pastry person, I find the savory folks' fear of pastry hilarious. I do get it to some extent, but every one of those people, particularly once you know you're going on Top Chef, I don't understand why you don't have a dessert option in your back pocket. The fact that they're constantly, I mean, and that could be a filming angle thing, but the fact that they're all like, oh my God. And like 45 minutes is not, like, it's not that short. There's so many options if you do it right and like you sort of get right down to it. And I mean, for this challenge, I felt like, okay, I didn't feel like any of them highlighted dairy. Particularly, I was like, Michelle, there's no dairy. She was like, here's my strawberry corn cake with basil. And I was like, there's no dairy. And the woman from Milk Bar was like, you have reconceptualized dairy in a new way. And I was like, what does that even mean?
Did you powder it?
So it's like,
no.
Early on in the challenge, I like stopped it and said to my husband, I was like, there's no dairy. Like, okay, she put some mascarpone cheese inside the... Anyway, hilarious to me that she won, just because, like, my whole commentary through watching that was, there's no dairy. And then I just, like, rewatched it again today and watched everybody sampling, and I was like, it feels like nobody was like, here is my dairy.
Yeah.
There was like, here are these, like, I put some butter in this. I put some whipped cream on it. And I was like, a no-bake cheesecake would have... Like a little mini one in the blast chiller would have worked. there were so many. I was like, no, even the cream puff, like he could have done like an open faced one with a ton of something in the middle or like an eclair. It was such a strange, like if you're going to go shoe pastry and go churro, which I get because Manny's Mexican, but also I was like, you could have, like there are ways to make that way more dairy. And it just felt like they were like, well, I mixed some milk in, so it's a dairy dessert.
There's a truck here in Madison that does churros and smash burgers. It's called Sin City, C-I-N-N.
Nice.
And their churros can be made vegan. And I thought about Dan's dessert, also the pudding, which can be made vegan. I had the good fortune to just eat at Esterev, and I had a dark chocolate pudding at the end that had like an olive oil kind of sorbet at the bottom and then like a hot, like dark chocolate kind of pudding, which is like hot and cold kind of thing. And it was very good. It was like sweet and salty and bitter and cold and hot. You know, it was really fun. A lot of contrasts would have been good for the Frank Lloyd Wright challenge. But having our Wisconsin guy even being like, well, I've got this pudding recipe, but it's vegan, so I'm going to put some cream cheese in it.
Of all the dairy, why?
Why?
Why cream cheese?
That baffled me. That was confusing.
And then he was like, no, I'm trying to get the cream cheese flavor out.
Yeah.
And I was like, what?
But why did you use it then? Like, what was
that? I have choices were made. Actually, as soon as he started, like when they're doing it and they're doing pudding, I looked at my husband and I was like, that is such a savory chef dessert to have in your back pocket, but I don't hate it because it's vegan. Like it is a very, like it serves a lot of purposes. Most people probably don't know it's vegan, but being dairy free covers a lot of allergen stuff. Like it made me laugh because it was just such a, like, this is a savory chef dessert. I also, why were there toasted baguettes on it?
I was so confused by that. That did not make any sense to me. Is it texture?
I guess. Listen. It's just that there's like very few people in this challenge that made sense to me. I mean, like Manny's, I was trying to decide, do you think, so Manny's churros, which you were like, I don't think they're crispy enough. And then he covered them in a ton of stuff. Was that to mask that they weren't, or did he not even think about it and then put his pretty soft churro underneath a whole bunch of wet stuff to make like a mush and not even realize how bad that was?
The best churros are like crispy, crispy, crunchy on the outside and have that little bit of tenderness as they smush. Right?
Right.
And then, but I do wonder if the timing, see, it was 45 minutes though. Like was the timing such that like, cause if it gets too hot, it kind of falls apart and maybe that's part of what it was. But also I often wonder about the timing of like when the chefs go, because they cut right between each course where there's like a little moment where they put the plates down and they cut and then they go back and they start filming again. And then the next chef brings. And like, if you're like the fifth person, I don't remember where Manny was in the lineup, but if you're not first,
I will say too, just going back, his pot of choux that he's stirring in the pot is lumpy and like very pale. It looks like real butter, light yellow. You compare that to Danny's pot of choux when he was piping it, was that like wonderful orangey yellow, really rich color. And I remember I rewound. I was like, what is happening in Manny's pot there? So like it really could have gone wrong from the very beginning, and all of that could be a moot point. 'Cause yeah, making pot of choux and then piping it into a deep fryer, like there is to me no reason why that wasn't done and why it wasn't crispy. But yeah, I was trying to decide if it was a strategic decision, like, well, crap, it's not crispy enough. Let them blame that on me putting stuff on it, as opposed to, or if he just didn't, he like really undercooked it and then also covered it in crap. Not crap, but like it was like a strawberry sauce and whipped cream. So like there's just no way, like even if it was the perfect churro, if he did that, it wasn't gonna eat
I'm
well.
just gonna go womp womp womp. I was gonna,
Yeah.
yeah. I wonder if this is a good segue into the choices that were made in the very confusing elimination challenge, the chaos cuisine thing happening. I don't think anybody really had a strong grasp of what that meant, including Maddie Matheson, who was like, maybe simplicity is chaos. And I was like, sir, you don't know your own thing. This is not it. And I think a lot of people were sort of calling that out along the way. Like, I don't know what you mean by this. Even Kristen was not sure.
I think that's okay in that, like, it's just a cooking challenge. If like if the answer is chaos, like what does that mean to you? I like it's crazy to me that so many people heard the word chaos and were like, well, these are just two ingredients that don't normally go together, or like made a bunch of fusion dishes and somehow thought that was chaos. Like, what year is it? It's 2003 and I am making Mexican Italian fusion. Yeah, I like chaos. It really, to me, highlighted how sort of like rigid fine dining can be, or like classically trained chefs that like they really work within these parameters and there's sort of a comfort for them. Like they find their lane and they go with it. And when they were like, no, take all of that away, every one of these chefs just kind of stood there frozen. Even the ones that we've seen think more outside the box, you know, like Danny and Rustico, though obviously Danny ended up winning. But I thought it was, I mean, there were so many composed plates. Like if one more person took out a towel to clean up a swipe on their plate, I was gonna scream, like, you are completely misunderstanding the point of this. Like the fact that Danny was the or Dan was the only one that just like threw a bunch of stuff on the plate that tasted good together. Yeah, I mean, make an ugly plate. It was so far outside their realm of thinking that like something could be ugly or weird.
Yeah, I really thought that Dan Jacobs was going to win this one, basically because his frankly looked like one of the most delicious. Like it looked really fun, and he had fun with it. Like he had immunity, so he
Yeah.
felt like he could play. And I just thought it looked great. I wanted to ask him when I was in the restaurant. I didn't, but I was like, I wonder if he's going to put it on the menu. Like, is he going to put it on the menu here or some version of it? Because it doesn't really fit with fine dining, which I think again is the point.
Yeah, I think the whole point to me of chaos cooking is to completely push all those boundaries or remove all the boundaries, and like no matter what, you know, some chef in culinary school told you that you still like think about every time you cook. Like, yeah, I don't hate that it was not well described, because I don't think there is an easy description, and I think that that's okay. I think, you know, you could have sold this. You could have put anything on a plate and sold it as chaos cuisine, I think. I would thought it was really strange how little they sold their own plates. Like, this is why I think it's chaotic. Like, this was my thinking, how this fits what you're telling me, as opposed to being like, here is my, you know, the same description they've always given. So I loved Dan just listing the like grocery store he put on top of it. But I think it's important too to point out, like, he did put 12 things on there and it still tasted amazing. Like, those things all helped purpose and melded well together, as opposed to just like throwing stuff on. I don't know. That whole the whole thing just so clearly threw all of the chefs. And I just like there were a couple things, like when they said Roscoe's was like a slug, I just was like, oh my God, that is like I would go hide in to walk in and never come
I
out.
I died a little bit when they said slimy and slug-like. I was like, oh God.
And they were like, she's like, I'm missing something. And Tom's like, it's the flavor. And I was like, oh my God, that is just like heart-wrenching.
Mm-hmm.
And then they compared the one to Hamburger Helper.
Yeah.
I was like, oh no, A, I have had that Hamburger Helper. And B, like, wow, what a, that's like a low blow.
Oh my gosh.
It's not, but I just like, for these chefs, I can only imagine if they had heard those things.
Yeah. I think a lot of the harshest stuff ends up cut because they don't want to seem actively mean, but being very blunt about the way that something failed is also good television often, you know? So
yeah, and it's, I think it's helpful for the chefs if they get to hear mm-hmm. it. Like, as in life, right? Like, you learn as much from your failures as you do, like, your wins. And so, like, if you put that on a plate and thought it was okay, like, you need to know why it wasn't.
Yeah. I liked that Michelle said, I don't remember if it was this week or last week, you're not going to hurt my feelings. Tell me.
Yeah, that was this week. She was like, I just, like, I want to know. I love her. And I was sad to see Ruska go, but like, I love everything about Michelle. I love that she comes from a barbecue restaurant, that she's so non-traditional, that she doesn't seem to have the same pretensions. She seems to be learning. Like, it's just everything sort of the antithesis of some of the like really hoity-toity chefs we can get, which I don't think we have any really this season in the same way that we've seen in previous seasons of Top Chef. There's nobody that like walked in full of ego, except for maybe the dude that went the first week whose name I already forgot. So it's like, that has been my husband asking, he's like, they're all very nice and friendly. Is this weird? My husband, who has never watched the show before, but watches with me now because it's in Wisconsin. And I was like, no, this is kind of rare.
It is.
Like, you think about like how like Richard Blaise was, or like Marcel was, like in previous year, you know, like you can name some of how these people were, and like there doesn't seem to be anybody that has that same sort of like, you're all here to just serve me.
That Michael Voltaggio energy. Yeah. Team Brian.
Yes. And he's a judge.
I know. I'm so delighted. I was so happy to see him there. I was thinking about, with like Michelle and Roska being on the bottom this week, I do think we're going to see another iteration of Last Chance Kitchen, and we'll probably see like another kind of parallel competition. It really felt like it had been sort of Rasika's challenge to win, and it is interesting that she didn't. With the challenge this coming week, this next challenge, which by the time this episode drops, people will have access to that one, the sausages. Are there things you're hoping to see in that sausage challenge, or do you, things that you think would make it complicated?
Well, it was funny. My husband was like, I'm sad they didn't do an actual outdoor tailgate. Like, it would have been cool to see them out, like, while a game is happening, and, like, an actual tailgate, dealing with the elements, dealing with cooking outside. It's like, that would have been just been fun, and that really would have showcased what, you know, Brewers tailgate culture is, which is so different. I think it's the same stuff that they kind of failed on this week, which is, like, getting the stick out of their butts about like food, and like food can be fun and should be fun, and like a tailgate is, I feel like we're gonna get like croquettes 2.0 or something, where they're all gonna make it too freaking fancy. Like, there's something really interesting about the, like I said, this like fine dining, classically trained, everything has to be, there's a time and place, right? Like the Frank Lloyd Wright challenge was the time and place for like Ruska and Danny to do that, like latticed and like all the fussy, like that was there. The tailgate challenge isn't the fussy place. The outdoor cooked cheese, the cheese in 90 degree weather isn't the place for that. So I just hope that they sort of embrace and understand, like, I'm standing outside in a jersey with a sweaty can of beer in my hand. Like, I don't need fancy. And I think also, because I like, there was the preview said like, he's serving hot dogs. Like, yeah, it's okay. Like, it's okay. You can like transform that. You can do interesting things to it. And then I'd say, like, sort of contradictory to myself, is that like, it doesn't just have to be hot dogs or brats. Like, I have tailgated with a full steak dinner at not Miller Park American Family Field. I have made breakfast. I've done like an egg bake on the grill. Like, there are, you know, and like, this is not, none of that was hard. It was, you know, like a tinfoil pan, and yeah, like there's a lot of options. And so I hope that they don't go too fancy, they don't just get stuck in a rut of like, I need something in a bun.
Yeah, I hear that. Thank you so much for being here, Nicole.
Of course. Thanks for having me. Love to talk about it.
That was Nicole Hazy, a Milwaukee-based food writer I am delighted to work with at the Cap Times. She often writes for the Journal Sentinel as well. You can check out her recent feature about Benz and Stoughton at captimes.com for a great example of her work. The Corner Table Podcast is sponsored by Garver Events. Host your event in the 100-year-old historic Garver Feed Mill in Madison, home to Garver Lounge, Ian's Pizza, and Role Play, as well as many other small businesses. For a full list of events, including cocktail classes, music performances, craft fairs, and more, visit garverevents.com. Up next is my interview with Paul Bartolotta. Paul is an award-winning chef who has worked in New York, Chicago, Las Vegas, and, of course, Milwaukee, where he now has 17 restaurants and catering operations around the city. Chef Paul was a judge on Top Chef for the first time in 2009, and you can see him judge the first episode of this season at Loopy and Iris as well. Paul is very well connected, and he has championed bringing this show to Wisconsin for years. He and I get into how Top Chef has changed over those years, what makes this competition so particularly tough, and why celebrity can't compensate if your food isn't great. Give a listen. Welcome, Chef Paul.
Hi, how are you, Lindsay?
I am so glad to have you here today. Thank you so much for making time. One thing that I noticed just back at the Top Chef launch party is how thrilled you seem genuinely to be. The Top Chef is finally here. I know you worked on this for a really long time. We're midway into the season. How do you feel like it's going?
I think it's amazing. It was many years in the coming, but couldn't be happier. Again, to the Top Chef team, I really take my hat off to them. Doneen is a force of nature. She has this incredible ability to make the locations that she chooses, the themes, the ideation for the challenges, so of place. And so, again, what she did in Madison, what she's done already in Milwaukee, and what I'm sure she'll do throughout the rest of the state is going to really showcase the state and the city. And I think it's really important. I think that the way her lens, her ability comes clearly through. I mean, you wouldn't be in your 21st season with 45, 50 Emmys nominations unless you know what you were doing. And she's great and couldn't be more excited. And yeah, it was a long time in the coming. I started pinging people still in 2019, so pre-meltdown, and stayed with them for all these years to get them to finally come and do this here. But it was a collection of people for sure.
I was having a conversation just before this with a Milwaukee food writer about previous seasons of Top Chef and just how the tone, especially among the contestants, seems to have shifted. And to me, it makes a lot of sense to see on a show set in the Midwest this season, to see a bit more collaboration, camaraderie, clear friendships among some of these chefs. Have you noticed that kind of evolution in the series as well, that maybe the tone has shifted over the years?
Sure. So even in the earlier years, I judged for the first time in 2009, I think it was. And you have just seen the evolution of food. You've seen the evolution of the show, the ability to create this natural tension toward the chef testants and the challenges. But clearly over the years, the camaraderie has grown. And I think in Wisconsin, I think you just clearly see that everybody's getting along and everybody wants to see each other succeed. I mean, not that you didn't in past seasons, but it's always sad when someone gets eliminated and you just see that person's emotion. But you see in some regard that mixed emotion when your relief that you're still in, but yet the sensibility that that could be you. And then the high empathy comes out of everybody. And I don't see in this year's group of chef testants really anyone who is completely self, you know, it's all about them. You know, I see them as really being part of a group of people that want to see everybody succeed. But at the end of the day, it's a competition. So, you know, you want to be the last person standing.
I feel like we saw a little bit of that kind of self-absorption with a very, very early contestant who was immediately gone, you know? And you saw it a little bit, and I'm like, oh, that feels like a flashback to a previous iteration of this show. But it doesn't fit in 2024. It doesn't feel like now.
The world has changed, and I think there is there's a greater sense of community nationwide, for sure, a greater sense in the culinary community. We're all learning from each other. And I think social media, I think that the ability to communicate and see what other people are cooking and doing, I think it's just run throughout the industry. And I think that Top Chef actually reflects that in how the shows are evolving, for sure.
When you're trying to weigh, like, they did the challenge, they understood the challenge really well versus this was a really delicious plate of food, where do you tend to come down?
So I start with yum. I start with yum immediately. If I don't like the dish, I just don't like the dish. I have a hard time going beyond that. The second thing I ask is, how well did that dish really reflect the spirit of the challenge? Whether or not there was a technique or a food combination or a theme that came through, that's critical. Then you move on to balance of ingredients, texture. Technical execution is very up on it. But it's interesting when you're sitting at judges' table, you know, there may be a thinner piece of fish and a thicker piece of fish. There may be an end cut on the steak or a center cut on the steak. So it may be slightly different. And I've had instances at judges' table where I had an item that was like right next to somebody else and mine was cooked perfectly. And I look, I'm like, not so much, or vice versa, where I got something that wasn't the way that it should have been. So it really depends on kind of what they're putting in front of you. And it's, again, I really bleed for these people. They're throwing it all out there. They're 100% in with what they're doing. And it's difficult. And make no mistake, this is authentic. This is real. These challenges are timed. They don't get heads up. And quite honestly, because they're so difficult, I think it's not uncommon to have dishes that are not particularly amazing because they make them look good and it's television. But when you're a judge, sometimes you get some dishes that are kind of like, whoa. But you got to really realize that you're in a foreign kitchen. You didn't know what it was going to be. The ingredients, it may be not even playing to your strength. If somebody has a background in pastry and they get a dessert, they should have an advantage. If somebody who maybe has had very little pastry training and they're asked to do something in the dessert realm, they may be way out of their element. So you simply have to like put that into context, but really understand how difficult this is and how real it is.
This past week's challenge being chaos cuisine, it seemed like many people were sort of struggling to define what that meant for them and what that meant for their dishes. I wonder what your perspective might be on chaos cuisine. Like, what would you do?
So I was watching that. And just when I heard chaos, I'm like, what the hell does that mean? And I can only imagine if I were the guy cooking, I'd be like, what would it mean? But I think that everyone interpreted it different, right? You know, someone like Danny, really high developed technique, and you saw that come through. But I'm a local, you know, supporter, and I thought Dan's dish was like kind of all over the place, but I didn't taste it, so I couldn't, but you could clearly see that it was pretty chaotic-y in sort of this concept from the funnel cake to all the seafood and whatever. And he was like cooking clams and lobster and shrimp and all the scallop or whatever it was, all this. And then his sauces, and it was kind of out there, but that's what they liked about it, right? So, you know, at the end of the day, it's, you know, Danny's did not seem chaotic, but in his own way, he pulled back what would be like the visible chaos to really do something out of the box where the flavor combinations were different and where he really showed his technique. So again, not having been at that judge's table, it's hard for me to truly judge it. Both of those, and there were other examples of some really interesting stuff that happened. And then there were others who just kind of couldn't get their arms around what that challenge meant to them.
Yeah, I think for some people it was like, we're just going to combine two different cuisines or make something sweet that's usually savory. And it does seem like you have so little time to like settle on what you're going to do and then start to execute it. Like you don't get a ton of build-up planning time, right?
You get none. And all the more reason why those that can figure it out and come up with a theme, You know, we talk about a lot in our restaurants here in Milwaukee, you know, that we are not just making dinner, right? We are taking a guest on a journey. So part of the real challenge is how does each of the Chef Teftons take the challenge, create a storyline in their mind before they grab the food or before they start cooking? Because if you don't kind of have an idea where the destination, you're sort of wandering around in the woods and you don't know if you'll find it. But I think if you, in your mind, you come up with a theme, you come up with a strategy, you come up with a story, so to speak, as to what you're trying to communicate. And I also think it's helpful when you present your dish that you're also able to sort of slightly convey, it's an advantage if you're a good communicator, to not let the judges just figure it out on their own, to tell them, here was my journey, so that they are preparing for it. So in our restaurants, you know, we take people to Italy, or we take people to France, or we take people to New England, and we're very clear and deliberate about that communication. I think that for the chef testants, it's critical that they take a moment to make sure that they are doing just that. And those that are good at it, I think, have an advantage because it helps the judges contextualize what you're cooking or what they'll be tasting.
Yeah. I have to say the esquites dish from Manny looked really delicious, like the reinterpretation of the risotto. But the churro that he made for the quick fire seemed to me to sort of miss the point of a dairy challenge, a dairy dessert challenge.
Well, and he put his cream on it when it was a little bit too hot, and so it was still hot and it sort of like melted it down. And so, you know, again, you could see, but he said, yeah, I should have waited a few seconds before. But you re but in the moment, gosh, you know, come on, it's so hard. Like, really understand how hard this really is. And you know, who becomes the top chef? And I think Tom and Gail for sure, Kristen for sure would have a better sense. But to me, it's the resiliency to be able to be, to never be the worst. Let's start there. You never want to be the worst. You always want to aspire to be the best. You want to take chances. And if you're going to win, you have to take chances near the end. But I think right now we're at a point where you have to demonstrate technique and flavor and stay true to the theme. Those are like the key ones. And I would say flavor number one, staying with the theme has to be in there. And technique, while important, isn't as essential as is it delicious and did it meet the theme? Because Tom is a guy who he's seen it all. Gail, I mean, they've judged all over the world. They dine all over the world. They're very savvy diners. So you're not going to like blow them away by some alchemy in the kitchen. They're going to remember something's delicious because I'm here to tell you, like, one of the first times I judged years ago, I tasted a dish. A couple of dishes, and there was a break between the next set that were coming out, and one of the hosts kind of said to me, "How you doing?" I'm like, "I mean, this was rough." She goes, "Yeah, I know. I've been doing this for years. It's rough. Sometimes it's really not very good." And I'm like, "Some of these dishes were just terrible." And yet you realize how incredibly difficult it is. So you're never critical because they're not given this is just really hard. And I'm quite convinced if you were to take best chefs in the world and say, here, you're doing this, not everybody would hit it out of the park. It's very helpful to have a controlled environment of your home kitchen, your ingredients, time to think through the vision and the mission of the dish and what the story would be. But all of that gets compressed here. And that's why, again, I sound the broken record, but truly give a lot of credit to the people that have done it, that have made it through it, that have won, because you don't win this unless you are flexible and adaptable and that you have a repertoire and that you're able and that you have solid enough technique and experience to be able to improvise, because a lot of this is improvisation, the ability to react spontaneously and quickly and find that you know, I call it, you know, that item that goes right down the center of the lane, not to make a bowling analogy, but like something that hits that center pin.
It does seem like the technical prowess or the ability to do very technical food has served some chefs well in the history of the show. Bude Allo is a great example of that, two wins back to back. Somebody like Richard Blaze, obviously incredible technique. You can kind of see that. Or with somebody like Gregory Gourdet, who has these wonderful influences and different like flavors that he brings. I think that as I've watched the show for so many years, right, you see them looking a little bit for surprise. like for personality and for surprise, in addition to those things that you mentioned, like the it has to taste good, it has to embrace the theme, but they also want to see a little something of you, of the chef, in each of those plates. And Chaos Cuisine seemed so open that it was almost overwhelming, I think, to some of these chefs.
Where do you go? Like, what does chaos mean to you or me? And some of the ideas were a little bit out there and some of them were a little safe. And I don't think you're rewarded for safe. I think you're rewarded for being out there. But at the end of the day, when you put all the plates in front of all the judges, they're going to begin with, in my opinion, they're going to begin with what dish tasted the best. And that's the one. And then if it's a really great dish, but it didn't meet the theme, then you start discounting from there. But if you have a great theme, but it doesn't taste good, where are you? If you have a beautifully presented dish with great technique, but it doesn't taste good, you're not going to go anywhere. So again, I love Yum. I stand by my Yum. Let's begin with Yum. I go back to the restaurant where there's Yum. At the end of the day, I go back where the food is consistent and it's delicious. And I don't think you go anywhere without those, with that element as a first starting point.
One of the things, as I've been covering Top Chef coming to Wisconsin over the past almost a year now, my goodness, is thinking about the way that this show has changed the way that we as diners talk about the food and think about chefs and the celebrity of chefs and how well-known chefs are now. This is a career-making moment for a lot of these chefs, right? And you're seeing them this past summer, like before everyone is going to know their name, right?
Yeah, I for example, a couple of the chefs I knew from before because I knew where they worked and I had seen them and met them in their kitchens. I did not expect to see Dan Jacobs there. And then when he walked out, I'm like, Dan? He's like, Paul? I'm like, what's good? He's like, I've been trying to be on the show for years. I'm like, really? He goes, yeah, I think I've tried like, you know, 8 or 10 times or something, or maybe more, to try to be on the show, and they never accepted me. And I don't think that they did it because he's a Milwaukee and we were thinking Wisconsin. I think that he got there because he earned it. And I think he's showing that he belongs there. He certainly is more experienced, has more years of experience than some of the other chefs. I think that will serve him well as the challenges evolve. And I think that, when you look at how the chefs have grown and you've seen the careers that have just blossomed, there are people that have made entire careers that were eliminated in the, you know, third or fourth episode. And they've, you know, known how to like piggyback on that. I think that the media has certainly played a significant role in the change in our industry. But regardless of that, I think that the consumer is more educated, more curious. But I go back to the same thing, which is, Yum wins. The media will say as much and talk as much as they can about what's exciting and what's topical. But ultimately, customers will come into your restaurant and they'll eat your food. And if your food isn't great, no matter how much celebrity you created around it, I don't think it will serve you long-term well. And I think that it's about the deliciousness of food and the ability to take a guest on a journey. That is what separates the long haul businesses from sort of the moment, sort of flash in the pan. And I think that very few people that have made it to Top Chef because of their incredible job at screening are people that are not already at a certain level that are going to show well, whether they have that one day that just the dish didn't come together or they weren't in their element and they get eliminated. The fact that you made it to the show speaks volumes, and the fact that you had the character and courage to put yourself out in such a public arena speaks a lot to their characters. And almost all the people that have been on the show at some point or another have benefited greatly by having done it. So I'm excited for all of them.
Well, hey, thank you for doing this today. Thank you for your time and your input.
Thank you. Well, again, we spent years bringing this to Wisconsin. And I remember the earliest call that I made to Joel Brennan at Governor Evers' office and said, listen, do you think they could get behind this? And from WEDC, Tourism, and Sayers, Governor Evers, Joel, everybody was on board almost immediately. And then when I spoke with Peggy at Visit, you know, she immediately said, I don't know how we're going to do this, but let's get this done. And Tim Sheehy at MMAC, all, you know, I sit on both of those boards and said, you know, how do we make this happen for Milwaukee and and for Wisconsin. And everybody came together, Door County, Madison, Milk Marketing Board, like so many of Cranberry, so many people jumped on and said, we want to showcase. And this was like a community coming together to bring it here. And the Top Chef crew, I have to say, literally, they have done already in the first few episodes, have shown why they're as good as they are, because they have made us look great. And I'm really proud of it.
We look beautiful.
Yeah, no. And what we should do is actually not, we should really embrace the fact that, like, I'm seeing things that I want to go there. I haven't been there. I need to go do that. I need to see this. And so we're building within our own community a sense of pride. But I think what's going to happen is, I know that we're going to have this huge influx of people coming to see and see what we already know as Wisconsinites, you know, why this is such a great place to live and work and cook and raise families.
Absolutely. Well, hey, thank you again.
Thanks for including me.
This has been The Corner Table, a podcast about food and drink in Madison, Wisconsin. It's produced by the Capital Times and me, Lindsay Christians. Our music was composed and performed by Patrick Christians. Dylan Brogan edits the podcast. For more Top Chef content, visit captimes.com for weekly show recaps by the wonderful Stephanie Bedford. Subscribe to our newsletter, where we share news every week about restaurant openings, pop-ups, special events, lots more. You can subscribe at captimes.com/newsletters. And Garver Events sponsors this podcast. We have our second and final watch party on Wednesday, May 8th, before an episode that may include some familiar Madison faces. At 7 o'clock, I'll be talking with Molly Moran from Table Wine about what you don't see on camera and our hot takes on the season so far. If you love Top Chef, bring your questions, bring your thoughts. We want to talk about them. Thank you for listening. And until next week, cheers. Cheers.